All right. Welcome, everyone, to another deep dive. Today, we're going to be tackling 1 and 2 Samuel.
Okay.
These books are pretty hefty.
Yeah.
And we've got a really fascinating lecture that we're going to be working through today.
Right.
And really what we want to do is kind of boil it down and extract those key insights from it.
Yeah.
You know, really give you a grasp on what truly matters in these books.
Absolutely.
So when we dive into these books, we have to remember that we're dealing with history, right?
Yeah, that's crucial.
But it's history written within a very specific context.
Right.
And I think that sometimes that can be forgotten, right?
Exactly. And, you know, it requires a particular approach, I think, to unlock their true significance.
Absolutely.
You know?
Now, these books aren't just isolated stories.
Right.
They're part of this bigger historical sweep in the Old Testament, right?
Right, precisely.
So just to kind of lay that out for you.
Yeah.
The lecture we're working from kind of lays out the books.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts them in this order. It says, okay, you got Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings.
Yep.
And those are all pre-exilic.
Exactly.
And then you have 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther.
Yeah.
So these books are a significant part of the Old Testament, right?
Absolutely. It's substantial.
I mean, I think the lecture notes, it could be like almost half.
Yeah. It's a huge section of the Old Testament.
And that kind of begs the question, like, why were they so focused?
Yeah. Why this intense focus on history?
On recording their history.
Right. Especially
compared to other ancient cultures.
Right. Right. Compared to other ancient cultures.
So that's something that the lecture really tries to grapple with. Mm-hmm. Like, why was Israel so invested in recording and remembering their history?
Exactly.
How did their understanding of history differ from other ancient cultures?
Yeah, that's one of the core questions that our source material really grapples with.
Yeah, and this is what I think is so fascinating about this topic is that, you know, we have this understanding of history as being like linear, right? Like it progresses.
Right.
It's moving toward a specific end.
Yeah, we have this sense of direction.
And this idea, actually, like the lecture highlights, guys like Burkhoff and Voss, they say that this idea originates with Israel.
Right. It's not from the Greeks or the Persians or the Egyptians. It's from this ancient people, Israel.
Right. And I think Voss is particularly interesting on this point.
Yeah.
Because he sees the prophets as instrumental in developing this idea.
Yeah. And not just kind
of history.
Yeah. Not just observing it, but understanding it as part of this divinely orchestrated plan.
Right. So it's not just a random series of events.
Exactly.
It's actually.
As meaning, it has purpose.
Yeah. It's teleological.
Yeah.
And it's moving toward a specific goal.
Absolutely.
Now, G. Ernest Wright, he also chimes in on this and he says that Israel had this really peculiar attention.
Yeah.
To historical traditions.
Right.
But it wasn't just about chronicling their history.
Yeah, it was about finding meaning.
It was about finding unity and meaning.
Exactly, yeah.
In all of history, starting from creation.
Absolutely.
So this idea of like a linear view of history, the idea that history has a purpose.
Yeah.
That's something we often take for granted today.
Right, and that's largely because of our Judeo-Christian roots.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the lecture contrasts this sharply with the you know, what was prevalent in the ancient world?
Yeah, the much more cyclical.
Yeah, like think about the natural rhythm.
Right, like the seasons.
The seasons.
Yeah, the sun cycle.
That could easily lend itself to an idea of history.
Yeah, just repeating itself endlessly.
It just repeats itself.
Yeah, or oscillating back and forth.
Or that it just fluctuates.
Without any real direct.
Yeah, and so Israel is really breaking.
Yeah, they're departing from that.
Yeah, it's a radical departure.
Absolutely.
From what everyone else was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how did they develop this unique understanding?
Yeah.
Now, right initially, he suggests that it was just through reflecting on their own story and inferring that God had this special connection with them.
Right.
But the lecture offers kind of a critical nuance here.
Yeah.
And they say that many ancient peoples had unique stories.
Exactly. They all had their own unique experiences.
So why didn't they arrive at the same conclusion?
Yeah, right. That's the key question.
Right. So the lecture argues that Israel's distinctive view stemmed from knowing God not just through the natural world, but also through specific historical events.
Yes. This is crucial.
That were both predicted.
And interpreted.
And interpreted by the prophets.
Yeah. So you have this word revelation, an event revelation.
Yeah, so it's not
kind of working in tandem.
It's not just observing events and then guessing at their meaning.
Exactly.
The prophets were essential
Yeah.
In explaining the significance of those events.
Right.
In light of God's promises.
And in light of God's overall plan.
And his overall plan.
Yeah.
And there's this great quote in the lecture from Voss.
Okay.
Says, without God's acts, the words would be empty.
Right.
Without his words, his acts would be blind.
That's so good. I love that quote.
It really clarifies.
Yeah, it really clarifies that interplay.
Like that interplay.
Between word and event.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without the prophetic interpretation, the meaning of historical events.
It would just be totally ambiguous.
It would just be up in the air.
Yeah, open to countless interpretations.
But the prophets.
Yeah.
They help to give us this coherent narrative.
Right. A purposeful narrative.
Yeah. Okay, so some might look at these Old Testament books
right.
and say, well, you know,
yeah.
they have this clear theological viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Can we really trust them as straightforward history?
Yeah.
And the lecture kind of pushes back on this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
They say that sometimes, you know, the cause and effect
yeah.
isn't always spelled out.
Like in modern terms.
In modern terms.
Yeah.
Like you think about Judges.
Yeah.
Israel does wrong
mm-hmm.
and God allows them to be oppressed
right.
for a time.
Yeah.
But they don't always connect all the dots for us.
They don't always give us all the political and economic
yeah.
and military factors that might be involved.
Yeah, so the lecture is acknowledging that these narratives, they're not primarily concerned
right.
with giving us this purely secular,
yeah.
detailed account.
Yeah, like a modern historian would want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The main concern is to reveal God's character.
And his redemptive work.
And his redemptive work. Through history.
Through the events of history.
Like, exactly. Well, this is the essence of what we mean
yeah.
by redemptive history.
Exactly. Redemptive history. Yeah.
So the events are significant. Not necessarily because of all the details surrounding them.
Right.
But because of their place.
In this larger story.
In this larger story.
Of God revealing himself.
Yeah.
And rescuing his people.
Yeah. And the lecture makes a really crucial point here.
Okay.
And it's this... All history writing involves interpretation.
Absolutely. There's no such thing as completely neutral reporting.
You can't just present the facts.
Every historian
yeah.
is operating with certain assumptions.
Yeah. They have a perspective.
They have perspectives. They have biases.
Right. And that shapes how they present.
Right. How they select
yeah.
and
yeah.
how they present the information.
So just because these Old Testament narratives have a theological lens...
Right.
That doesn't mean
yeah.
that they're historically inaccurate.
Exactly. It doesn't disqualify them.
Right. They're still recounting real events.
Yeah.
But those events are foundational.
Right.
To the whole message of the Bible.
To the entire message of the Bible. Yeah.
And to the Christian faith.
Right. I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
The lecture even mentions Paul's statement about the resurrection.
Right. Like if that didn't happen.
If that didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
Then our whole faith crumbles.
Yeah.
So the historical grounding is really essential.
So this brings us to 1 and 2 Samuel.
All right.
These books are, they're long.
Yeah, 55 chapters.
55 chapters.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and the very name Samuel points us
yeah.
to this key figure.
Right, a pivotal figure.
Yeah, and the lecture highlights that Samuel was God's chosen leader.
Mm.
And he plays this crucial role in anointing both Saul
and David.
And David.
Right, as the first kings of Israel.
Yeah, so the establishment of kingship under Samuel's guidance.
Yes.
That's a central theme.
Absolutely a central theme.
That we're going to be exploring.
That runs throughout these books.
Now, Samuel himself wasn't the author.
Right.
But the lecture suggests that these accounts may have drawn on his records.
Right.
And possibly the records of other prophets.
Yeah, like Nathan and Gad.
Like Nathan and Gad.
Yeah, which is interesting because...
And that's actually referencing 1 Chronicles.
Right, 1 Chronicles mentions
yeah.
records from Samuel, Nathan, and Gad.
Yeah, concerning David's reign.
Yeah.
So that gives us a little bit of a window
yeah.
into...
peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, into the sources behind these narratives.
Yeah, the historical sources that might have been used.
And then another thing that's interesting
yeah.
is that 1 and 2 Samuel,
mm-hmm.
they were originally one scroll.
That's right.
That was later divided.
Yeah, by those Septuagint translators.
Yeah, probably around the time of Saul's death.
Yeah, right around 1 Samuel 31.
So, you know, it's interesting how the text has been...
Yeah, it's been transmitted and divided. And...
Yeah, transmitted, divided.
Yeah.
And there are all these different titles
right.
throughout history.
Different traditions called them different things.
The lecture mentions how sometimes they're even called the Books of Kingdoms.
Right. Yeah, in some traditions.
So where do these books
mm-hmm.
fit chronologically?
Yeah, where do they fall?
In the bigger picture.
In that grand sweep of redemptive history.
Yeah, so the lecture explains that they kind of bridge
Yeah.
The era of the judges.
Okay.
And the dawn of the monarchy.
Right. So they're kind of this transitional period.
Yeah, it's this transitional period.
Yeah.
And roughly speaking, they cover
1100 to 970 BC.
1100 to 970 BC.
Yeah. Give or take a few years.
Yeah, roughly.
Roughly, yeah.
And it's not just like this comprehensive political history.
No, it's not a textbook.
Right, like we might expect today.
Yeah.
It's more a collection of these biographical stories.
Right, we see these key figures.
Centered on Samuel.
Samuel and David.
And David.
Yeah, they're the main players.
And the source really emphasizes this idea that the unifying thread.
Yeah.
That kind of ties all these stories together.
Mm-hmm.
Is this interconnectedness.
Yeah.
Of kingship and covenant.
Kingship and covenant, yeah.
Yeah, God's relationship
yeah.
with his people.
Absolutely. That's the heart of it.
Yeah.
You know?
And the lecture
mm-hmm.
actually outlines this four-stage development.
Okay. Interesting.
Of this theme as the narrative unfolds.
Right. So how does that work?
Yeah. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, certainly.
This fourfold development?
So first, the lecture suggests that the people's demand for a king
mm-hmm.
in 1 Samuel chapter 8
okay.
was essentially a rejection.
Okay.
Of their covenant relationship with God.
Okay, so their demand for a king
was a rejection of God as their king.
Yeah, because he was their king.
Right, exactly. He was their ultimate king.
Okay, so that's the first stage.
That's the first stage.
Okay, what's the second?
All right, so the second stage is the establishment of the kingship under Samuel.
Okay.
As we see it kind of depicted
mm-hmm.
in 1 Samuel 10 and 11.
Okay.
And this kingship was intended to operate within that covenant framework.
So they reject God as king. And God says, okay, fine.
Yeah, you want a king.
You want a king, you got it.
Here's a king, but yeah. this kingship is going to function.
Within my covenant.
Within my covenant.
Okay, and then what's the third stage?
The third stage is the reign of Saul.
Okay.
And particularly as it's illustrated
mm-hmm.
in 1 Samuel 13 and 15.
Okay.
Demonstrates a failure.
A failure to uphold.
To uphold the ideals.
Of the covenant.
Of covenantal kingship.
Okay, so Saul's reign kind of shows us.
Yeah. What happens when you don't follow God's ways?
Yeah.
When you try to do things your own way and,
yeah.
you know, things don't go so well.
Yeah.
And then finally, the fourth stage
okay.
is the kingship under David.
Okay.
In Tekken Samuel.
Right.
And while it's not without its flaws.
Sure.
David is presented as a more faithful representation.
Okay.
Of a king who seeks to live in accordance with God's covenant.
Okay. So we've got kind of this progression.
Yeah, there's a progression.
Yeah, we see the people reject God.
Right.
God gives them a king.
Right.
That king fails to uphold the covenant.
Right.
And then you have David.
Who tries to do better.
Yeah, who's a better example.
He's not perfect.
Yeah, he's not perfect.
But he's trying.
But he's striving.
He's seeking to follow God's ways.
And that's really helpful.
Yeah, it gives us a framework.
That gives us a framework for understanding the narrative.
Exactly.
Now, the lecture also breaks down the books.
Okay.
Based on those primary figures.
Right.
So you've got Samuel in 1 Samuel 1:12.
Right.
Then you have Saul in 1 Samuel 13:31.
Mm-hmm.
And then David in 2 Samuel 1:24.
Right.
And it's interesting that yeah. in the Hebrew Bible,
yeah.
they actually give more space to David's reign.
They do.
Than they do to Saul's.
Yeah. Which I think suggests its significance.
Right.
You know, they're placing a lot of emphasis on David.
Yeah. And so within this overarching narrative.
Yeah.
of redemptive history, 1st and 2nd Samuel,
yeah,
they mark some really significant advancement.
They do, absolutely.
In God's plan.
Yeah.
And the lecture highlights three key developments.
Okay, what are those?
That I think are particularly worth noting.
Yeah, I'm all ears.
So first we have the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham
mm-hmm.
regarding the full extent of the promised land.
Right, that's a big one.
Yeah, that's a huge one.
That's foundational.
Now we know that God initially laid out these boundaries
mm-hmm.
for Abraham way back in Genesis.
Yeah, all those geographical markers.
Yeah, so the lecture reminds us of those promises
mm-hmm.
in Genesis 12, 15, and 17.
Right, laying out the extent of the land.
Outlining these borders stretching toward Egypt.
Right, toward the Euphrates.
Toward the Euphrates River.
Yeah.
And this promise is reiterated
mm-hmm.
and reinforced.
Throughout the Old Testament.
Yeah, throughout the whole Old Testament.
Yeah, we see it pop up again and again.
You see it in Numbers, you see it in Deuteronomy,
yeah.
Joshua, even in the Psalms.
That's right.
But while there was an initial taking of the land, when Israel entered Canaan under Joshua,
right,
the conquest wasn't absolute.
Right, there were still pockets of resistance.
There were areas that remained under the control of other peoples.
Yeah, And the full extent of that territorial claim wasn't fully realized yet.
So how do 1 and 2 Samuel demonstrate this promise reaching its complete fulfillment?
Well, the lecture explains that it was during David's reign, as chronicled in 2 Samuel 8, that Israel's dominion was extended as far as the Euphrates.
Wow.
Through his various military victories.
So David's the one who finally...
He's the one who really pushes those boundaries and secures those boundaries.
Yeah, and this is later affirmed in 1 Kings 4.
Right.
During Solomon's reign.
During Solomon's reign, yeah.
And the lecture really points to this as this powerful demonstration.
Of God's faithfulness.
God's faithfulness to his promises.
Right, his unwavering commitment.
Yeah.
Even when circumstances might have made it seem impossible.
Especially considering what was going on during the time of Samuel and Saul.
Yeah.
It's like God is working out his purposes.
Yeah, he's working behind the scenes.
Yeah, even when it doesn't look like it.
Yeah, even when things look bleak.
The lecture mentions the weakening of major powers like Egypt and, you know, various Mesopotamian entities.
Right. So God is orchestrating the rise and fall of these nations.
And this creates this window of opportunity.
Yeah, this little window.
For Israel's kingdom to expand.
To reach its full potential.
Yeah. All right. So moving on to the second.
Okay.
Key advance.
Mm-hmm.
Jerusalem becoming the political and religious center.
Yes. How does that all come about?
How did that happen?
Yeah.
So this pivotal shift occurs when David, after becoming king over a united Israel.
Right.
He strategically captures the city of Zion.
Or Jerusalem, as we know it today.
Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And establishes it as his capital.
Right.
And this is recorded in 60 Samuel 5. So right away, we see its political significance.
Yeah. It's elevated.
Yeah.
Politically.
But then in 2 Samuel 6.
Yeah.
David takes this really significant step
mm-hmm.
of bringing the Ark of the Covenant
to Jerusalem.
To Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So this really solidifies its role as the central religious sanctuary.
Right, for the whole nation.
For the whole nation of Israel.
Yeah.
And that act of bringing the Ark must have been so symbolic.
Right.
The Ark contained the tablets of the law.
Right. It was the tangible representation of God's presence.
Yeah, it was like God's throne on earth.
Yeah. His earthly throne.
And so even though David was now this human king, by deliberately bringing the Ark to Jerusalem.
Yeah, he was acknowledging Yahweh as the ultimate king.
Yeah, he was submitting to God's authority.
Right, recognizing that God was the true sovereign.
Yeah, and so this event really cements Jerusalem's...
Yeah, its central importance.
Central importance.
Throughout the rest of the Old Testament.
Not just for the Old Testament.
The New Testament.
Into the New Testament.
And even today.
It still holds significance.
It's remarkable how this one event has had such a lasting impact.
That's a legacy that resonates through millennia.
Yeah, through millennia.
Okay, so now let's talk about the third.
Okay.
And perhaps the most theologically significant advance, the establishment of kingship.
Mm-hmm.
And this really profound concept of the Anointed One.
Yes. This is where 1 and 2 Samuel really break new ground in the narrative of redemption.
Okay.
So the lecture explains that it's within these books that the phrase, the Anointed of the Lord, becomes this standard and really deeply significant title.
For the King of Israel.
For the King of Israel, exactly. Yeah. And it's here that these crucial linguistic connections to the terms Messiah and Christ emerge.
Yeah.
So those English words, anointed, Messiah, which is a transliteration of the Hebrew Meshiach, and Christ, which comes from the Greek Christos, they all originate from this fundamental idea of ceremonial anointing.
So the very roots of the messianic expectation.
Yeah, they're embedded in these historical accounts.
And we see that firsthand with the anointing of Saul and the anointing of David.
Exactly, those key moments where Samuel anoints them as kings.
And the lecture points to the narratives of Saul's anointing in 1 Samuel 9 and 10.
Yep.
And David's anointing.
In 1 Samuel 16.
In 1 Samuel 16.
Yeah. And that phrase, the anointed of the Lord, becomes this recurring and really significant designation.
Yeah. Throughout 1 and 2 Samuel.
About both books. Yeah.
Now, the idea of kingship itself wasn't entirely new, was it?
No, it wasn't brand new.
The lecture reminds us that there were these hints and prophecies.
Right, scattered throughout the earlier books.
Yeah, earlier in the Old Testament about future leaders
Arising
in Israel.
Right.
So they point to God's promises to Abraham and Sarah about kingship within their lineage.
Right.
Jacob's prophecy concerning the scepter not departing from Judah.
That's a big one.
Yeah. And then Balaam's prophecies foretelling this powerful king.
Yeah. He sees this king coming.
And even Moses includes the law of the king in Deuteronomy.
Right. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And even Hannah's prayer in 1 Samuel 2 anticipates this future king.
Yeah. So the idea is there.
The idea is already there.
But 1 and 2 Samuel mark its institution.
And they mark the significance.
The profound significance.
Attached to it.
Yeah.
So the lecturer walks us through these five literary units in 1 Samuel 8:12.
Okay.
That detail this establishment of the kingship.
All right.
So first you have Israel's demand for a king in chapter 8.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Samuel's private anointing of Saul.
Right.
Then Saul's public selection at Mizpah.
Yep.
Then the confirmation of his kingship through victory over the Ammonites.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the formal inauguration of Saul's reign at Gilgal with a renewal of the covenant.
With a renewal of the covenant, yeah.
And what's really striking and theologically important is the underlying reason for Israel's request for a king.
Right. What's really driving them?
Yeah. So the lecture emphasizes that their demand in 1 Samuel 8, to be like all the nations.
Right. They want to be like everyone else.
I want to be like everyone else.
Yeah.
It stemmed largely from their dissatisfaction.
Yeah, they weren't happy.
With Samuel's sons.
Yeah, they thought his sons were corrupt.
Yeah, so they were looking at Joel and Abijah and saying, you know, these guys aren't cutting it.
Right. We need a real king.
But the lecture argues that the deeper issue was this fundamental lack of trust.
Yeah, a lack of confidence in God.
And confidence in Yahweh is their true king.
Yeah.
So their desire to have a human king.
To judge us like all the other nations.
To judge us like all the other nations.
Yeah.
It was at its core.
Yeah.
A rejection of God's direct rule over them.
Absolutely. It was a turning away from their unique covenant identity.
They wanted to conform.
Yeah, they wanted to fit in.
Yeah.
Instead of standing out.
And the lecture quotes those verses that explicitly convey God's perspective on this rejection.
Right. God's not happy about this.
No, he's not happy.
Yeah. He's their king.
Yeah.
And they're rejecting him.
But in spite of that, God instructs Samuel to grant the request.
So not without a warning.
Yeah. He's going to give them a warning.
Right. He's going to lay out the consequences.
He's going to tell them how these kings.
Yeah. These Canaanite kings.
That's not a king.
Operate.
they take.
And the lecture really emphasizes how the people just insist.
Yeah.
They're stubborn.
Stubborn. Expert speaker.